1967, I was completing my PhD in Ann Arbor, the University of Michigan, in history and geography. And at the time, I had gotten out of the Army, and my wife and I were living in Nebraska, and I was teaching in a junior college out there, and it was rather hard to complete a doctoral dissertation from Nebraska to Ann Arbor. Mm-hmm. And so one summer when I was here, summer 47, I became aware of a vacancy here in the social science department. And so I applied to Walter Fee, who was the chairman of the department, and he gave me an appointment, and I've been here ever since. Now, what's a historian, so to speak, doing in social science? Well, I always thought history was a social science as opposed to humanities. And yet you see two schools of thought on that. In some schools, the history department is with the social sciences, but in another university, the history department is with the arts and letters humanities area. So it's debatable. Mm-hmm. So I've been here since 47. When I came, there were 7 departments in the basic college. 2 of them were essentially social science. One was called social science, the other one was called effective living. Then there were 2 science departments. One was called biological science, the other one was called physical science. And there were 2 humanities departments. One was called history of civilization, and the other one was called literature and fine arts. And then there was a freshman English course, which was simply called written and spoken English. So there were 7 departments. In 1952, the basic college was reorganized, and the 2 related departments merged into 1. So the 2 social science type departments, effective living and social science, became a new department of social science. The 2 humanities type departments, literature and fine arts and history of civ, became a new department. They merged into the humanities department. And the 2 sciences became the natural science department. And written and spoken English became still the English course, but it was changed to communication skills. Historically, that's the way the format pretty well went along until the name change, when Basic College was changed to the University College.
What year was that?
As I recall, it's 57, but I can't swear to that. I think it was 1957 that the name changed. And the reason for the name change is because we were a college of the whole university. So we were simply called the University College. Well, yes, and of course the word basic college, for the people who didn't understand general education, they thought that the word basic meant preparatory, sort of make up the deficiencies from high school, mm-hmm. which of course it wasn't. But so the basic college frequently conveyed an unfortunate connotation in the minds of a lot of people, just like the general college at the University of Minnesota still plagues the general education movement, because I don't know if you're familiar with the general college out there, but because it predated us, but it was strictly for deficiencies in high school training. So if kids who applied to the University of Minnesota were not capable of, their grades were not good enough to get them into the College of Literature, Science and Arts, or not capable of getting into the College of Engineering, they were all put in the general college. It's sort of a remedial
thing. About 1932,
yeah. And of course the general education movement has been plagued by that image in the minds of people who don't really understand general education.
One of my professors said that even the name general education causes the problem.
That's right.
I wish they could come up with a better name for it.
Well, and when you talk to Lee Winder, from my perspective, he doesn't understand general education. To him, the way I put it, general education to Lee Winder is with a small g and a small e, meaning education which is broad and general, distributed among the principal fields of knowledge, as opposed to general education with a capital G and a capital E as a distinct philosophical, structural organization of curriculum. So you're right, the general education as a name. Well, when Chicago and Columbia and Harvard all fussed around with this thing, the word liberal arts, of course, had sort of been preempted. So they wanted to find something that was would be new enough that would cause people to take notice on it. Mm-hmm. And they recognized that liberal arts education, well, if liberal arts education had been true to its tradition, you wouldn't have needed general education at the big universities. But they didn't, and so part of it was political. In other words, and this has been a thing that's plagued general education supporters such as me all these years, in order to push our position, we have to downgrade our colleagues in the specializations, which makes them mad. So we're in an awkward position. We have to criticize them, or at least suggest we're criticizing what they're doing, in order to support our position.
Philosophically, yeah.
So, well, you go
so
ahead.
So, up to about 1952, it's been reorganized. Yeah. You've also got a department, as I understand it, of research and statistics, but also was your board of examiners.
Yeah, right? The old board of examiners. When I said that there were seven departments, I should have said eight if you count the board of examiners, but there were seven teaching departments,
yeah.
And then Dressel's board of examiners, and then Bill Warrington's, and mm-hmm. so on. And then it became institutional research. Part of it because the departments in the university college who used to give a common term-end exam, that regardless of who your instructor was, a departmental final was given to all the students, and that's where the board of examiners, their technical expertise in test construction is what they gave to us. We gave the content and wrote most of the questions, but they would take the questions we would write and put them into appropriate machine-scored objective-type test format.
Mm-hmm.
And the examiner who was assigned to us taught our course, one section of our course, so he knew what the course was in his own right,
mm-hmm.
let alone add to it his technical testing ability.
I didn't realize that. That's
yeah.
One thing I haven't picked up on is that each of those...
Yeah, the man we had was named Harry Berg, and he has a PhD in history originally, but taught social science, and then came here. He got his PhD was history, but with heavy statistics and test construction from the University of Iowa. And so that's what attracted him to the Board of Examiners here, was a chance to use statistics and examination construction with teaching social science.
When I was talking to Dr. Warrington, and we talked about the fact that I was here in the early 60s, he says, you were here during the highlight, when everything in the University College was doing exactly what we wanted it to do.
Yeah.
And I said, well, you know, I felt like I was in the middle of something very exciting. I felt that way at Michigan State from the first moment I got there, after I got over the terror of realizing I'd accidentally stumbled into a major university coming from a small town in Wyoming. But I said, well, then where did it all start to unravel? What occurred? You know, and that's kind of where I have stepped back, and I would rather not say what others have said, but would rather hear your side. It seems so far that everybody has basically said around about the same thing, but I'm still interested in hearing it from your point of view, because you were here the longest of all the people that I've talked to in the University College.
Well,
again, do you feel it started to unravel?
Okay, now this is my personal feeling, but I think I could verify it if I had to. Okay, you as a student in that period will recall that students in the 60s and early 70s were, there was this tremendous drive to do your own thing.
They came just after I left.
Okay.
It was
beginning, you see, there. And the student activist groups were opposed to all kinds of requirements. And of course, the university college was the biggest requirement that every student on this campus could confront. In fact, I used to kind of jokingly say that one of the things University College did for MSU was to focus all the opposition, because every student on this campus took something in the University College, regardless of what their major was. So you had an element of commonality.
Which was your purpose in
exactly.
the first place.
Well, okay. So in part as a response to this increasing demand of students for more flexibility, aided and abetted by a class of faculty who were added to the university, who were specialists. So they were aided and abetted by faculty. The demand for more options, more choice. Well, the university college reaction to that was to establish what we called the track system. Now, that meant that the way it was originally conceived, each department then would offer two or three variations of the same thing. Now, I take pride in the fact that our social science department, we only offered four tracks, all essentially the same. Each track used regardless of who taught the track, each track had a common textbook. But we held on to that in my department as long as I could, but I had a lot of opposition from our own faculty. But what happened in the other departments, the faculty that they had been employing and appointing, those faculty wanted to do their own thing just as much as the students did. And so this whole notion of a common textbook and a common final examination was an anathema to some of the young faculty people that we appointed at the University College. So what the other departments did is they they had half a dozen different tracks, and then inside each track, each professor pretty well taught it exactly the way he wanted to teach it.
So in essence, you became the very thing that you were fighting.
So then, in essence, we became a variant of the old distribution system. And when we get to Winder, that he used to throw that back at us all the time.
I have interviewed a couple of retired professors, or deans, I should say, of other university colleges that were not the university college, but like arts and letters and things like that. And they point to that as the starting point, and said one of them made the comment that when you guys started branching out like that, you became a direct threat to their departments because you were doing what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And some of them said, what was the difference? You might as well be in our department.
Yeah, well, and that's exactly why in our social science department, we held rigidly to the social problems approach, mm-hmm. the social issues approach. So that when we had a sociological focus, we were focusing on social issues and social problems, not focusing on sociology as an intellectual discipline. So we were not, sure, there were a lot of common knowledge and common vocabulary, but when we talked about socialization, it was in reference to a social problem or a social issue. Whereas when sociology would talk about socialization, well, that's a sociological concept, and they would look at it more or less in a vacuum, just as an intellectual conceptualization. So when we talked about culture, it was always in relationship to an issue or a problem, whereas when anthropology talked about culture, well, culture was a basic concept to the whole field of that. So that was the basic difference. So you're right that our own University College faculty have to bear some of the blame for the gradual loosening and the gradual disappearance of commonality. Mm-hmm. And the second C, coherence. Mm. Because as long as you had common textbooks and common exams, you had a commonality and you had a coherence. It held together. Well, then when the faculty began insisting on choosing their own textbooks and writing their own examinations, there you are, yeah.
One of the administrators that I have spoken with, and with two exceptions, one because I didn't realize until just the last couple of days that he was involved in any shape, not the former Dr. or President Hardin. I haven't asked to interview him, but I asked to interview President Mackey, and he chose not to be interviewed. He's the only person who has not, but I have either have or am in the process of interviewing every living president and provost that was involved. And one of them made the comment that in the 70s, there was also a push by a very small minority in the total faculty for unionization.
Yeah.
And that some of the most vocal firebrands were within the university college, and that also cost, within the administration, cost the university college some friends.
Yeah.
And I've heard both ways, and I was just curious as to what your feelings were. Did you feel that some of the leaders were...
Yes, and I'd also add another curiosity there. During that period, the university faculty revised their whole bylaws and established a grievance procedure, so that if a faculty member had a grievance, he or she could file her complaint with the grievance officer of the university, who was a faculty person. Okay, I would have to admit that a big share of the grievances that got filed came out of the university college faculty. And I can tell you a personal thing that I don't want to, I mean, everybody knows it, but I was a department chairman who got sued by a faculty person in federal court because we didn't grant him tenure. So I was the first chairman on this faculty, for this whole university, who got hauled into court, who was sued by a man who we did not grant tenure to. It went through, well, first of all, he filed with the Michigan Labor and Industrial Relations Board, and they found no cause for action. So then he filed in federal district court in Grand Rapids, and well, then it took two years before it finally reached the court, and so we had the court case, and he demanded a jury trial. Well, the jury found in favor of him against MSU and against me, but the federal judge had taken the case on a jury basis, that the jury was only advising. And the judge found in our case, he found in our favor, and overruled the jury. Well, then the man appealed to the Sixth Federal Court of Appeals in Cincinnati. In the meantime, a couple more years go by. Well, then they ruled that there had been errors in procedure, so they sent it back to Grand Rapids, and we went through the whole thing again. Well, anyway, to make a long story short, we finally won. Now, the irony of this, and this is why if you talk to other university people, don't mention it, because the man is still here. His wife is on the faculty. The man is still here, and he comes up a lot here to this department. He's unemployed, but he's been here since, that case was finally settled in 1978 or 79, and he's still around.
How did he find the money to fight that long?
Well, he got some money from ACLU.
Oh.
Because he alleged, that's why it went into federal court, that a violation of his freedom of speech and due process.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, back to your initial point. I think you're right that an awful lot of internal conflict seemed to kind of reside with the university college people. Now, I can in part explain that. General education faculty at a big university are always second-class citizens in relationship to where the accolades go. The accolades go to the graduate professor and the research professor. And so higher education, academia, that's the way the reward system goes. Now, faculty here, our salaries were comparable, so we didn't suffer too much financially. But status-wise is what bothered an awful lot of university
college.
What
would be an example of? What kind of status?
The answer, you're out socially and somebody says, oh, you're just university college. You're just university college.
Oh.
And unfortunately...
I had the nerve to actually say that
to
your face.
And this is... I used to get so mad at our own colleagues here, because I never felt it. And now part of it is because I knew lots of people on this campus, so I didn't confine my knowledge or our social life with just university college. But I used to get so mad at some of my colleagues when they'd meet somebody they didn't know socially at somebody's house, some faculty member's house, and the person would say, oh, what department are you in? Some of my colleagues would say, oh, I'm a sociologist, but I'm in social science. Oh, I'm a historian, but I'm in humanities. I'm a zoologist, but I'm in natural science.
Low self-esteem.
That's right. So this meant that a lot of the normal irritations that you and I feel as academicians, most of the time you let them go. They irritate you, make you mad, but you know, what the hell. But a lot of our people just kind of struck out, you see, at the system that they felt that they were being downgraded. And now, Bill Warrington, that you've interviewed, Bill was just like me. I mean, we did our job. We knew loads of people in this campus. They would ask us for our thoughts. The central administration knew us and asked us. But an awful lot of the ordinary classroom professors didn't circulate. And so they didn't have much contact with the rest of the department. Now that's important to remember when we get to Winder and one of his thoughts.
Well, yeah, the next thing I wanted to talk about is one of the things that keeps coming across in talking to many people is the key role of administrative support from president and provost.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear your thoughts.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, that where you had successful general education programs at big or little colleges, you've always had strong administrative support from the central administration, from the president's office or the prof's office or both. And this is one thing that began to lose when John Hanna himself became so involved in the Civil Rights Commission. Then he just didn't literally have the time to give all the attention that he used to give right here on campus. And so he began leaving more and more philosophical educational decisions to Jake Neville, his provost. And Jake was a nice guy, but not really an educator. Good administrator, friendly, you'd like him as a person. But he didn't really have the big picture in terms of educational philosophy.
The feeling I got, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, was that as long as Dr. Hanna was here, because of his past practice of very strong support, people who might have been against the University College really weren't willing to take it on.
That's right. They kept quiet.
Those within the University College that were trying to do more things and to reach out were being held back by Neville. Because I've got a couple of letters where that I dug up in the archives of the Hanna papers where Dr. Carlin had proposed some programs to Dr. Neville and said, you know, could you share these with Dr. Hanna? And Neville's answer back was, not at this time. This isn't the appropriate time. And was stalling him.
Mm-hmm.
But once Hanna left, that what happened, you know, with Dr. Warrington? Was Dr. Warrington very strongly supportive? Or how did you feel his position was?
Yeah, Bill, and I've known Bill ever since I've been here, ever since he's been here. No, Bill was a strong supporter of the University College. And Bill's a very dear friend of mine, neighbor and all that, and we knew his first wife, and his kids grew up with my kids and so forth. So he's a good friend of mine, so I'm not telling tales because I've argued with Bill. Bill is not very articulate when it comes to supporting an educational philosophy unless he can back it up with statistics.
Mm.
I mean, it's just his own intellectual bent.
The insurance thing.
Yeah, he just is not used to dealing in conceptualizations of abstract ideas that you don't have statistics to back up. And so
I've gotten the impression from the others, I wanted to hear it from you as well,
yeah,
that he was supportive of the program.
Oh yeah.
I'm meeting with him the third week in July in New York. I'm looking forward to it.
Mm-hmm.
You see, after him came Hardin, and I would like to know what you felt, because I get the impression that's when it really kind of all came to a head. Provost Winder was the provost, and
Ed Hardin, are you going to see Ed?
I hadn't thought to see him.
Ed is, I've known Ed since he came here the same year I did. And there was no rental property available, so Ed Hardin and I Hardin family and the Dunham family ended up in the faculty bricks over here on Cherry Lane.
Yes.
And Ed and his wife and family were just across the hall from us. So I knew Ed well. Well, Ed is a politician par excellence. And so Ed, when he was acting president here for a while, then president, they just changed his title, he really didn't care much what was going on here. He was an outward-looking president, a good politician. And we did all right financially during his tenure, because he had such good relationships with the legislature. Now, see, he came here from northern Michigan, where he'd been president up there. He left. He was a professor of education here, then dean of continuing education, or dean of lifelong education, mm-hmm. here, then became president of Northern Michigan University, then retired from up there, came back to live here in East Lansing, and so here he was, available when MSU needed an interim president, and so there he was. So Ed didn't really pay much attention to what was going on, and Ed was one of these people that if he did not want to be on the losing side of any controversy. So if there was rumblings and controversy about general education on this campus, Ed didn't want any part of that, because he wasn't so sure which way it was going to go.
Huh?
That's right.
And so it kind of fell to the provost.
Yeah, so the provost became the principal, well, as they should be, the principal academic officer of the university.
So now we're right to...
So then we get to Lee Winder. Lee was, he came out of psychology originally. His background, as we critics say, he's a rat psychologist. He did all of his research with rats at Stanford. And so he was in the psych department here, then became dean of the College of Social Science. And the interesting thing there is I was on the dean search committee for that college, and he was not my first choice, but I tell you that in confidence, but he got it anyway. And then when the provost's office became vacant, he was named provost of the university. There was a short interim there when blocked his name. He's president of Ohio of Oklahoma State. blocked his
I
name.
I know you're thinking of too.
Yeah, he just came out of Ag Econ here. Larry Boger.
Yeah.
See, Larry was, and I hated to see Larry go because he was a strong supporter of University College, but he wasn't here long enough. As a provost, he was here a long while as professor, but not as provost. He wasn't here long enough to really.
Where's Larry now? Because I've been.
He's president of Oklahoma State.
Okay. Someone suggested now my speaking with.
Yeah, if you can.
I can't get out that far. This,
no, but I mean maybe you can give him a phone call.
Oh, that's amazing.
And if you want to use my name, just say Doug Dunlap of Michigan State said I should talk to you. If he's got time, why? Or he'd know Bill Warrington too, so you could.
Dr. Cantlin and.
Yeah, or John Cantlin, yeah.
Also said the same thing that she talked with him. I was rushing from one thing to another, so I hadn't really pulled out my director to see exactly where he was.
Well, anyway, so Lee became provost. Now, John Cantlin had been provost in for a short period in there too, and then became vice president for research and graduate education. I've known John for a long while. Because he was another one of those Cherry Lane apartment people that we all knew when we came here together. John was never a supporter of University College. He wanted the old-fashioned distribution. He would like to make, and still would, and our present provost, unfortunately, is the same way, would like to make Michigan State either carbon copy of Ann Arbor or MIT, which I think is ridiculous. In one state to have two German educational systems, and that's what Ann Arbor's promise is based, you know, history of education, it's based on the old German concept of a university.
In the 1870s.
That's right, and I have a marvelous quote from the Detroit Free Press, and old President Tappan at Ann Arbor, way back in the mid-19th century, said that, was quoted as saying that the University of Michigan is modeled after the Prussian system, the finest example of higher education in the world today. That was his Ann Arbor. The Detroit Free Press editorialized the next day by reminding President Tappan that Ann Arbor was not Berlin. I thought that was a marvelous one. I sent that to old Mackey once, but to remind him that East Lansing was not Ann Arbor. Well, anyway, when Winder became provost, Winder's definition of general education was distribution, broad coverage of the principal fields of knowledge. And to him, then, you could achieve that by asking everybody to take the introductory course in any one of the principal fields of knowledge. So in social science, take Sociology 101, that's okay. Or take Anthropology 100. Or take Psych 106. All those introductory courses, and then that's your social science. Then you could take in the arts and letters, take an English course, or take a year of foreign language, or take a European history introductory course. That takes care of the humanities. And in the science field, take introductory botany, or introductory biology, or introductory chemistry. That takes care of it. So that was Winder's notion that, and he always used the word general education. And that gets me back to small g and capital E that I mentioned earlier this morning, because I used to have some real arguments on it. So that was one thing. He never really bought the educational philosophical underpinnings of the university college, despite the fact that he always said he was a strong supporter of general education. Yes, education which is broad and general, but not general education. The second thing here was he did not like the notion of a separate administrative agency. He thought that all of the general education people should have a departmental affiliation in a specialty. Well, that's consistent, you see. If you define general education as introductions to the disciplines, well, that's where the faculty should come from, then, the disciplines. So, given the notion that he didn't really like the definition of general education as we followed it, and he didn't like the organizational structure that we had here because he thought all these people should be back into the departments. Then he had a, plus the fact that he had, he was provost at a very difficult beginning of a very difficult budget problem on the campus here, the legislature's appropriations and so on. So increasingly, you found faculty in the disciplines looking, okay, sociology would look at my department with 6,000 students, and here they were with 150 in their introductory sociology class, you see, that they looked with jealousy. Plus, and then let me throw in another interesting fact, and this is from John Cantlin. When John was provost, he made what I've often said one of the worst damaging statements on educational curriculum that I've ever heard an administrator make. And I told this to John himself to his face. He said, dollars will go where the students are. And that set in motion on this campus imperialism, turf management, expansion at somebody else's expense. So, you get you get a provost who was not philosophically in line.
The department falling on its own sword.
Yeah, that's right. Students. And so on. By then, when we got the big budget crunch in the first days of Mackey's presidency, and I was on the presidential search committee there, and this is off the record here, but
because I had the same thing happen to me. I was a finalist for a large city school system, and there was one nut on the board who wanted the inside assistant superintendent, who'd only been there 1 year, didn't have any experience. And he not only released my name, but released it in my present district. Right. And there were some hard feelings, like, well, he's a, you know, you mean he came down here and he's going to leave us immediately? Well, we'll get even. And it cost me both yeah. positions.
Well, anyway, we ended up with Cecil Mackey, who, by the way, did what needed to be done, but Cecil Mackey doesn't have an ounce of public relations sense. He does what needs to be done, but he does it in such a way that he alienates people. Well, going back to general education and Lee Winder, this meant this budget crunch. Everybody's got to save money. And one of the things Winder proposed then was to do away with the university college. We'd save money, we'd farm all these faculty out to their respective departments, so they wouldn't need new faculty. We've got all those people. We'd keep the courses going, but we'd do away with the department, or the college. Well, the college then got done away with, and Bill Warrington was named acting dean in the last years of the college, and there was to be a transition committee composed of the acting dean would be Bill Warrington, and a committee drawn from the so-called core colleges, arts and letters, natural science, social science, those are the core colleges, to kind of work out the ultimate demise of the university college. Well, you throw that in on top of the budget crunch, and Winder wanted to do away with it immediately. Well, this is where I had a major fight in public with Winder in front of the Board of Trustees, and I won. The trustees backed me, not Winder. And, well, Lee's remained friendly. I don't think he ever forgave me for going right to the trustees and winning. And all I did was postpone the demise of the college, but at least we postponed it and hopefully got a little bit more rational approach to the demise of the program.
If you were to look at the University College model, putting the personality problems aside, what did you like about it? What didn't you like about it? What would you change?
I would try to develop, organizationally wide, I'd try to get mutually acceptable, or there's more of mutually acceptable dual appointments, so that somebody in my social science department would get to know some of his colleagues in sociology or anthropology and whatnot as a colleague. Now, I would not go so far as Winder, who wanted everybody to have a dual appointment. Now, we used to have, my department had more dual appointments than any of the other university college departments. And so we've done pretty well with the College of Social Science, and are the two chairmen since my time have done okay with the College of Social Science.
Dr. Winder said that the administration used it as a vehicle to create dissension. The dual appointment system.
Well, I think maybe that's partly true, but he was the one who pushed it.
Mm.
The present provost didn't learn anything from that. And this doing away with the departments and putting up the so-called Centers for Integrated Studies. Anybody, if the provost had asked any of us old-timers, we could have told him what was going to happen. That the discipline departments, for one thing, aren't very happy with accepting these people to be assigned to their departments now. Now, with respect to our department, we've done pretty well. I think there were only two people that nobody would have wanted. Whereas arts and humanities people and natural science people have had a hell of a time.
Dr. Heckel said that some of their people have had a hard time.
Because the departments, discipline departments, didn't want these peasants coming from general education.
What do you think of the idea of having the university model and then having specialists come in on a rotation basis and maybe serve for a year or two and then go back to their department so that you don't have the dual appointments set up, but you've got a feedback back and forth, almost like the best description I can give to you is like a foreign exchange student, because in a way it is a foreign exchange, where someone would come in and work for a year or two and then would go back to their department having some knowledge of the general college, and vice versa maybe even.
I'd say that would be fine if you very carefully selected that person. Because there are, all general education is not taught necessarily by the general education faculty. There are some professors in chemistry who do a damn good job of general education. Mm-hmm. They don't call it that, but they do. So I would say if you had visiting professors, so to speak, from the disciplines, occasionally teaching, that would be fine, but they have to be carefully selected. Now let me tell you why I say that. When the basic college was first set up, and before the basic college began hiring its own faculty, they had to staff these courses with existing faculty. And what did the discipline departments do? They gave all of their worst people were farmed off to teach these general education courses.
See, that's what I was thinking. The person that comes in from the specialized area goes back, so that you can't do that kind of thing. I've seen that happen on the secondary level, where you'll have a couple of elementary schools trade for teachers because of certification and that. And I've watched principals dump their, quotes, troublemakers. Right. I would rather see it where the guy says, now if I send him out, I know he's coming back.
Yeah.
So I better be careful who I've sent.
Mm-hmm.
Because when he comes back, I may be haunted by my decision, or I might be complimented.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I say that would work if you very carefully select it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, by and large, I would say, given American higher education such as it is, I would predict that won't work, because you just don't find enough people who would be interested in teaching general
education. So you'd have to have some kind of motivation.
So you'd have, that's right, you'd need a comparable reward system so that it became a feather in your cap to go over and teach, even though they were only freshmen or sophomores, to teach in that general education program.
Did you like the idea of the University College being a separate administrative unit?
Yes, very much so. Because that way we had our own budgets, we could fight our own battles, and it enabled us to put our primary emphasis on teaching as opposed to research. Now, sure, we wanted our professors to do some research and to publish.
Yeah, now, that's something that's interesting. Quite a few of the guys that I've talked to have said that these teaching professors also did a significant number
that's
of publications,
right,
to the point that they were on par with their cohorts.
Absolutely. But we never got credit for that in the minds of our colleagues in the discipline. So our guys here in this department published and gave papers teaching 12 hours as a professor over in sociology teaching 3 hours. Our guys published just as much as that guy.
Well, I can see how resentments could build.
And in fact, two of the men that are in sociology now, just had a cup of coffee with them before you came, they've laughed frequently. They're in sociology now, and they said that the sociology department was just amazed when they sent their thetas over to them with all these publications. They thought the University College faculty didn't do anything. But the administrative unit gave us, it had its disadvantage in the sense it separated us, but it also provided us with a cohesive administrative unit to fight our battles.
Mm-hmm. I would share something with you that goes into my personal history, that goes right to Dr. Dean Winder's, Jimmy Provost Winder's comment about taking those introductory courses. I did my first couple of years at John Carroll University before I transferred up here. Mm-hmm. John Carroll had a pre-engineering program, and for financial reasons, I stayed close to home.
Mm-hmm.
I took all the introductory science courses, the introductory chemistry for future chemists, introductory physics for future physicists, because they had a strong science department, but they didn't have an engineering department. So I didn't get the chemistry for engineers, I got chemistry for chemists. It wasn't until I was in a natural science class and turned to one of my professors, and I forgot his name, but I think they said his name was Fred Lewis.
Ralph Lewis?
Ralph Lewis,
yeah.
Ralph Lewis.
He's still around. In fact, I just saw him going across the street here.
I'd like to catch up with him, because if it's who I think it is, we share an old story that I want to laugh with him about. But I remember going into his class one day and saying, you know, there's one thing that has always bothered me, and nobody has ever stopped to explain. I've seen all the stuff I've seen in physical science about atoms and molecules, and I've seen all the stuff I've seen in the biological science about cells. What's the connection?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, the connection is, and he proceeded to explain, the living matter is unstable atoms, unstable molecules, and that it needs to feed on this energy that it draws from other molecules in order to maintain the balance. And all of a sudden, the whole universe of science made sense. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't have got that taking just the fundamental introductory courses, because nowhere in there would have been someone who had brought it all together and said, well, here it is, and just like that answered my question.
Yeah.
So, you know, so general education doesn't serve a purpose. It drew
those
things together.
Well, then, of course, this is where you get to the difference in objectives. You see, the chemistry course you took, they were training you as a future chemist. And that's what they wanted to pass on, meeting the demands of the discipline of chemistry. Whereas a natural science, a general education course, what kind of scientific, quote-unquote, knowledge do you, the ordinary citizen, need to know to live in the 20th century? So,
which goes back to, go all the way back to Jefferson.
Yes.
And just,
you can press that.
Yeah, let's stop at this point.
I'm going to...